Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. This art walk is a campus-wide evening of exhibits and gallery spaces open throughout the night, bringing Taylor students, artists, community members to experience visual arts and creative work across Ringling College. WSLR is here on site with music and volunteers as part of our mission to connect Sarasota with local arts, culture, and community voices. More information about Ringling College is available at ringlingcollege.gallery. To learn more about WSLR programming, community events, and to listen back to shows, visit WSLR.org. Now, back to the music here on WSLR.
Programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. This is the Progressive Paige Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them. Supremacy shapes everything from the geopolitical landscape to our most intimate relationships. Social conservatives blame feminism for a host of societal problems and pine for a lost world where women, confined to domestic spheres and child-rearing, lived only to support the men in their lives. Their nostalgia ignores the reality of women's lives when men had complete control over them. In countries like Afghanistan, where patriarchy is firmly in control of women, they are denied education, health care, movement, and even public existence. It's only been within the last few decades that women have gained a measure of control and autonomy in the U.S. Marital rape was not outlawed in all 50 states until 1993. Access to credit and bank accounts was severely limited until the 1970s. In 1972, the right to access birth control was granted to unmarried people, and this had a profound effect on women. But male supremacy also limits men. Their concepts of how they can be in the world are curtailed when gender roles are strictly enforced. Their intimate relationships are tainted by the dictates of a worldview where men must always be in control. In her book, All We Want is Everything, How We Dismantle Male Supremacy, Soraya Shamali takes a deep dive into how we're all impoverished by traditional heterosexual gender roles. Soraya, thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you for having me, Marianne. I'm delighted to be here.
A criticism of feminism that's been rolling around lately is that men are being systematically devalued and it's gone too far. Does that mean we're finally making real progress?
We've made steady progress for about 100 years in the U.S., slow, steady progress towards the idea that women can be independent, free, fully adult people in the society. And I think it's interesting that that goal, first of all, is kind of reviled and that it's interpreted as a direct assault on men. The only way really that you can come to that conclusion, I think, is if your understanding of men, masculinity, maleness, manhood is constructed around, as you said, the control of women, the oppression of others, because the reasoning is so zero sum that you can never be free to explore what the benefits to men have been. The initial point of the argument to say that feminism has hurt men and has gone too far is that if you benefit women, men have to lose out. And in some ways that's true, only because the starting point, there's such an asymmetry of power. But in other ways, it's completely untrue because feminism has massively helped boys and men in societies. Societies that are more egalitarian and feminist are healthier. People are happier. Men have richer emotional lives and more egalitarian sensibilities overall.
I would think that not having the pressure to be the sole breadwinner is also a benefit for men.
You would think that, right? And I think this is so important. Feminism is a political movement. And as such, it gets categorized often by people in what they might think of as the public sphere. But our ideas about gender and particularly masculinity are manifested in the public sphere, but their genesis is in intimate life, in identity formation, in relationships, in childhood, in parenting tactics. And so the idea that somehow helping men defray the pressure of work stress sounds good, but it actually ends up being very problematic because so much of men's identities are built around being providers. The relationship between being a good man and money and earning money and being that sole provider is completely entwined. And so the question I always ask is, what would men be like if we had a masculinity in which they just had intrinsic worth, in which they didn't have to be providing and producing and performing masculinity all the time? That's a tremendous stress. Little boys should be able to have the sense that they are worthy in and of themselves, not because they will somehow grow up to be rich people.
But part of the problem with the financial inequality is it's such a coercive system. When the men have all the money, then women have a hard time leaving abusive relationships.
Oh,
because
absolutely.
That's their only source
of
income.
Power.
Money is power.
Money is power. I was just focusing on the entwinement between masculine identity and wage earning, right? So, for example, in our current political system, economic stress and job market metrics are really calibrated to men and men's lifestyle, life needs, and men, male-dominated jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And that connection is still very, very, very powerful. But as you say, it goes far beyond that, because when you have these asymmetries of power between men and women, when you institutionalize inequality by not paying for care as a society, by abandoning social safety nets and care infrastructures, by coercing and forcing women back into unpaid work at home, you are giving men that control that we just talked about. And I think a lot of people, conservatives, for example, will say, well, women need more flexibility in their jobs and they're naturally more inclined to take care of children and to be oriented towards the domestic. That's all well and good, but it ignores the degree to which flexibility in that sense is actually precarity for women. It leaves them incredibly vulnerable.
And we'd all be better off if men had flexibility so that they could help with the childcare and we weren't put in a position where we're the sole caretakers of children.
And elderly. It's children, it's the elderly, it's on the front line of things like epidemics and pandemics or natural disasters. Women bear the brunt of most of those care-intensive situations. And today, more than 2 years ago, for example, there are a lot more women in homes doing that work and being the shock absorbers of our policy changes.
You make the case that male supremacy isn't incidental to the cascade of problems we're experiencing, but it's at the root of them. The one that I stumbled on was climate collapse. How is climate collapse linked to male supremacy?
That's such a good, well, first of all, in its outcomes, women and children, but particularly women, are the hardest hit by climate collapse, by the environmental degradation, by the stresses and pressures put on communities and on families and on human bodies, because we have responsibility to care for them. And we're also generally the keepers of social networks and domestic spaces, and in any emergency situation, in any migration situation, in any refugee situation, which we're going to have so many more because of climate change, women are again on the front lines, but also made more vulnerable because of escalating violence, escalating sexual violence, escalating intimate abuse violence. So that's sort of one thing. But I would argue that part of the issue we have with climate change denialism right now is clearly that many men, particularly powerful men, particularly white men who are accustomed to status, are engaging in what many studies show and have for decades, identity protective cognition. In order to protect their status, to protect their sense of their own identities and a certain kind of manhood, they are actively denying that climate change is something that can be mitigated and that they have greater power to mitigate it. And so from that perspective, you have this flavor of masculinity that is so destructive to science, to social policy, to our health and our bodies. And it's really tied up with this ideal of masculine power or strength. That goes hand in hand with another concept called petromasculinity, which is a kind of masculinity that's hyper invested in petroleum, in the ideology of extraction, in the cultures and the industries and the war-making machinery that protects and seeks out oil as the fuel of the world. So those things are combined, but it's very hard to get away from the fact that they are not just combined, but also so closely tied to notions of masculinity for a certain subset of people.
Those notions of masculinity spill over into so many aspects of our lives. The need for some sort of spirituality seems to be an innate human trait. How does patriarchal religion, is that redundant? Aren't they all patriarchal?
That's a good question.
Enforce unequal treatment of women.
I grew up Catholic, for example. Went to Catholic schools my whole life through college. And throughout that time, pretty young, stopped practicing that faith. And I stopped practicing that faith around age 11 or 12 because I had the very rude awakening that women were not able to become priests, for example. And so I think that we really need to understand two things. One is all of these major religions in our society are patriarchal. All ritually silence women to some degree or another. All over-index masculinity is affiliated with divinity and saviorhood, and also put men in the position of having to mediate salvation for women. And that's not, at least for me. Now, I think that's thing one. Thing two, though, is that we're socialized. And this was a kind of real shock to me when I came to the United States, the degree to which people believe that religion is separate from politics or religion is separate from work. This is a fantasy of abstraction because every single time you take a child into a house of faith, where only men are speaking and representing God, you are teaching that person, and maybe you have several children and you take them, you're teaching those children very important lessons about who has authority, who has visibility, who has social trust, who has power to define culture. And those children don't leave those lessons in that house of faith. They grow up to be adults who take those lessons to work with them, to school with them, into politics. And so I just don't have much personal tolerance for the idea that people's religion doesn't shape the society I have to move through. And we see that in spades today. The driving force of anti-abortion policies, people's faith.
I don't know why all these men in dresses get to make decisions.
I know. Funny. Every authority that men, when they reach high authority, the dresses come out. It always makes me laugh. The robes, and every society it happens. You look at judges, you look at priests, you look at people who have high status, and very often they're men wearing dresses. They don't call them dresses.
So one of the traditionally male roles is that of protector. And let's put aside for the moment of the fact that most of the time women need to be protected from their male partners. Mm. And let's talk about how women protect men.
Absolutely. I find this fascinating. I was talking to a book club last night and someone asked me a similar question. And I was really struck by, again, how gendered the word protection is. Because what men are doing when they seek to protect is they're caring for the people that they love. They're exhibiting and exercising care for them. And yet we don't call it care. We call it protection. When women do the same thing, we call it care and we don't call it protection. There are infinite ways that women are constantly protecting. they protect men by de-escalating violent situations, by not sharing emotionally challenging information. One of the examples I use in the book is that from very young ages, most girls and women experience street harassment. In my case, it started when I was probably 8 or 9, and it was very persistent. It was daily. And yet I learned from my mother, my aunts, all the women around me to not talk about it, and definitely don't talk about it in front of men. It was just not done. And one of the effects of that is to protect men from what they could perceive to be a failure to protect me. It was an emotional protection for them. And unfortunately, that kind of emotional protection ends up in emotional fragility. So that fast forward 40 years, when I'm talking about Me Too, a lot of the men in my life were like, what are you talking about? How could that be? How could that have been a daily occurrence for you? And so I do think that the emotional protection of men is high on the list. But we also do other things. As the keepers of households, as the primary producers of food in a lot of families, as the managers of family health, we make sure people aren't getting sick, that they're not eating toxic foods and substances, that they get their vaccines when they're supposed to, that all of these things that we do that aren't called protective.
The Sarasota Shell Club presents the 2026 Sarasota Shell and Marine Life Festival on Friday, February 6th and Saturday, February 7th at the Sarasota Fairgrounds. Attendees can learn about seashells and sea life, plus view unique shell art and learn from scientific exhibits. Hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. both days. Founded in 1963, the Sarasota Shell Club is a nonprofit organization of seashell and fossil shell collectors. Activities include meetings with guest speakers, shelling excursions, and social events. More information about the Shell and Marine Life Festival, as well as the Sarasota Shell Club, is available at sarasotashellclub.com. You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Saraya Shamali. Her book is All We Want Is Everything. Apparently, women moving into professions that they traditionally weren't in creates what's called male flight. What do you mean by the term male flight, and what's that done to certain professions?
Sure. I think teaching is a good example. Male flight basically is a sociological term that describes men's mass movement out of any area, sector, when women reach a certain proportional level of the people in that sector. If you think about something like maybe shop clerks at some point in history, all of them were men. And then when women started doing it, pay started to drop. This isn't one way that this happens. The job starts to become devalued because feminization is a stigma, and the men leave. And when the men leave, pay drops a lot over the course of 5-10 years, 30% in that sector. That happened in teaching, for example. At one point, teachers were mainly men, and then it became women, and then men left the profession. And now we're being told that because there are too many women, boys are being hurt in the boy crisis. But no one's really talking about the fact that, in fact, what is the dynamic of what's happening with boys checking out of education is a male flight dynamic. Because they associate education and academics with femininity and women and girls, they're taking that step out and they're looking for other status building and entitlement based systems that they can join. So it's almost as though any sector where women succeed becomes sullied and men move on. So if you think of the social sciences, once women started going to college and started entering social sciences, men started leaving those social sciences and they aggregated, and this is a corollary term, the male fortressing. They went into economics, which is male fortressing in that men then dominate and are hostile to women. There's so much hostility. Philosophy, the same thing. Men go into these spaces because they've withdrawn from places where they're competing with women and women are achieving parity or even doing better.
What happens when women adopt the competitive masculine energy models for succeeding in the workplace?
Well, I think many of us know what happens. They're punished for it because it feels transgressive. I wrote a book about the social construction of anger a few years ago called Rage Becomes Her, which includes a lot of research about this specific topic. But when women exhibit what we think of as leadership qualities, they have to be very different from the leadership qualities that men exhibit and that are prioritized, among them being competitiveness, aggression, confidence, the assertion of authority. Men don't have to be excessively gentle or friendly or communal in their expression. Recent tech world, we need more masculine energy, is really nothing more than a reassertion again of patriarchal norms of behavior.
What's the form of the backlash against women in higher roles in hierarchies?
We've seen so many examples in the last 10 years in our presidential elections. The thing about it is, for many people, the combination of femininity with the desire for leadership breaks rules. It feels really wrong to them because it defies their gender expectations. And so what you end up with is this profuse misogyny that punishes women for seeking power or for expressing power or for expressing authority. And that conflict is most clearly seen in the role of the presidency, because in our history, all presidents have been men, but the presidency itself is associated with the very patriarchal notion of a father of the nation. And there's no way that a woman can be a good father of the nation in that framework. And so any woman, no matter how competent, cannot ever be a good fit if that is the ideology behind the thinking of so many people.
And then the way that we view all of those systems is now being baked into the technologies that are going to shape how society goes forward. You write that, quote, hitting the mute button on entire classes of people is now a practice woven into artificial intelligence. What led you to that conclusion?
Well, I was in the tech world, tech and media world, as an executive for a very long time, between the late 90s and the early aughts. So I had personal, professional experience with data and media and technology. And then I started using social media extensively for the purposes of writing. And the immediate response to my writing, for example, was just gross hostility. Online harassment, threats, very ugly commentary and contents. But the reason I mention that is because that harassment was replete with stereotypes. And those stereotypes, that language drifting around databases and platforms of the internet, is now baked into large learning models for AI. And we know that all the large learning models for AI have taken language like that. And I mentioned that language, it's kind of the cherry on the top. That language is replete in most of our data sources. You have gender and racial biases in scientific literature. You have it in history. You have it in literature. You have the kind of embedded biases of the society baked into words and language, and that is what large language models have used to train AI. So unless you correct for those biases explicitly, then AI is going to amplify and expand them at scale. We were talking about, for example, independent women and the relatively recent history that has led to women having some small measure of independence. For many years, I've kept a running log of what I call women's refusals, women who won't conform, women who choose to live in certain ways that are outside of patriarchal norms, white supremacist norms, hetero norms. I'd had a document where I dumped it all. And when I was writing this book, I categorized those things into different groupings. And I thought, okay, well, what have I missed? I'm just curious. It's just so much information. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to do an AI test and see what happens. So I dumped my list into an AI and I said, this is my list. This is how I compiled it. I'm looking for ways in which women seek independence from men in their lives, decentering men. And the AI responded with, I cannot complete that task because of misandry.
So it's saying it's hateful to men to have women independent of them.
That was exactly its logic. And that logic comes from its large language model training, because the aggregated information that it analyzed led it to the conclusion that independent women was a factor of the hatred of men. I burst out laughing and I was like, are you kidding? And I said, explain to me your own bias, because all I'm saying is the following. And it then apologized and said, you are correct. I don't have enough feminist sources in my training model.
Wow.
It's not like this AI knew who I was. I wasn't logged in, for example. I hadn't used it before. It was just a pull up a browser, ask the question.
I want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier. You were saying that it's people who are living outside of the norms that are the threat. Is that why there's so many attacks on gay, queer, and trans people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The definition of male supremacy that I use comes from the Institute for Research on Male Supremacism. And the definition, which I know how much thought went into this definition. The definition is essentially a system that privileges cis men, cis straight men, and positions them as the rightful leaders and holders of power in the society to the disadvantage of women, LGBTQ people, and I would also add to that definition minoritized people who, by virtue of their status, are feminized in a society. They are forced into the position of being women.
You mean black men?
Yes, black men. Historically, if you look at the oppression of black men, the mechanisms through which they have been oppressed turn them functionally into women. So you can't get a job. You can't own a gun. You can't walk freely in the street. You are subject to higher rates of sexual violence because you've been incarcerated. You just go down a list, and the point is to emasculate black men in the society. Don't give them the ability to exercise the dominant hegemonic masculine norms and rights, earning, providing, and protecting. If black men can't provide and protect, are they men at all, is the way the oppression goes. And so I do think that if we look at the assaults on trans people and gay people and lesbian people and non-binary people, that stems directly out of an ideology that says there are men and there are women and there's no changing that, which is the official policy of our current government.
A lot of Gen Z men seem to be buying into those kinds of policies too, and they're becoming more conservative. What's going on there?
I think it's very complicated on one hand, but not very complicated on another. As I try and explain in the book, because of that idea that there are men and there are women, we really don't appreciate the degree to which our entire enculturation is sex segregated. And so even if you think about feminism, we taught generations of girls and women about feminism. We taught them to look forward and to envision lives that were sometimes quite radically different from the lives of their mothers and their grandmothers, and to conceive of the world as theirs to define in new ways as they gained rights or liberation. Boys and men were not exposed to that because, of course, feminism is for girls and women. We sex segregated feminism. And so boys and men, and studies show this, are much less likely to be exposed to intersectional feminist thinking, to progressive thinking that is related to that. And we end up socializing boys and men towards the past, to look at past glory and replicate that glory and replicate those styles of masculinity. I would also say with Gen Z, I have kids that are in Gen Z. I saw this firsthand as a parent. Gen Z kids were raised in the wake of 9/11. And after 9/11, the entire country was reeling, and a very prevalent message to society was that we had to develop resilience, and that resilience was hyper-gendered. That resilience was men have to be strong, warriors. They have to embody the defense of the nation, the honor of America. And women had to do it, but in very gendered ways. They had to be hyper-vigilant mothers. They had to impart the right values. There was a gendered split as to how to respond and be resilient in the wake of 9/11. And young men in particular were subject to really retrograde ideas about what it meant to be a man.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is